Thanksgiving is not that far in the rearview mirror, and it is always around Thanksgiving and the holidays where I spend a lot of time thinking about gratitude. This year, I am incredibly thankful for our sponsor, Shire, for making this podcast, this episode, and all of our episodes on the Bloodstream podcast possible. Thank you, Shire. Hello, and welcome to the Bloodstream Podcast, episode 31, December 17th, 2018. I am Natalie Lynch. Last month, we told you we were going to resume normal programming on this month's episode, but we're deciding to keep you on your toes and make a pivot. This month's episode, I will be presenting 2018, a year in review, highlighting some of Bloodstream's greatest moments of the past year. Now, I was the one who curated these moments, so the term greatest might be subjective, but they're my absolute favorite moments of 2018, and I think you'll like them too. Also on this month's episode, Believe Limited's Ryan Gielen will be hosting an exclusive interview with one of the teens who participated in Breaking Through. All that and more, welcome to Bloodstream. A year in review. Can you believe the year's coming to an end? I can't. It's crazy. This year flew by. I had so much fun going through all the episodes and picking out some of my highlight clips to share with you on this episode. And what I think is so great about this episode is if this happens to be the first episode you're listening to Bloodstream, this is a great sort of potpourri of what this pod is about. Just a couple highlights of different things that this podcast offers. And, it was really, really just so much fun to go through all these episodes and pick out some of my favorites. Starting with last January, we had Susan Lynch, Patrick's mom, on the podcast, and it was fun to chat with her to kind of go through what it was like, her perspective as a mother of being a new family with hemophilia diagnosis, and just to kind of hear Patrick and his mom talk openly and candidly about their experience with hemophilia. So I hope you enjoy this clip. Kicking us off, Susan Lynch.
Guest, so she's just getting ready. Last looks happening here.
Makeup and hair.
Making her feel real embarrassed. Mom, how many podcasts have you done so far to date?
None.
You got to hold the mic a little closer to your mouth.
None.
You look very excited to do your first today.
I'm very excited.
So we're here today with my mom, Susan Lynch. Say hi, Mom.
Hi, everybody.
And we're here to talk about, she's so happy to be doing this, but she shows it in her own special way. So we wanted to talk to you today, about your perspective on, obviously the podcast is about hemophilia and people have heard me talk about it a bit, but your perspective as a mother, and maybe just to start off talking about when you first found out, we didn't have any family history of it. So
correct, yeah.
Can you talk about how we first found out that hemophilia was in the family?
Well, you were about 8 months old, and actually for the few months before you even were 8 months old, maybe from 4 months old, you had a lot of bruises under your arms where I would pick you up. And then when you were starting to crawl around 8 months old, your knees got very bruised. So I asked the pediatrician about it, and he told me you probably had a liver enzyme deficiency.
It wasn't his first thing just like, oh, he's just a bruiser.
Yeah, he said, my wife bruises very easily. But I found that summer, it was summertime, that I was bringing you to the town pool and keeping a T-shirt on you because people would stare.
And because I knew that was so bruised.
And I knew that wasn't normal, correct, yeah. So then we went to a hematologist. And actually, when the doctor came into the waiting room, he said without even examining you, he believed you had hemophilia. He knew right away.
And where was it?
That was in where?
Yeah.
In North Shore Hospital.
Gotcha. Okay. And when you heard that, we were actually talking about this, Natalie and I, in the car on the way over. We hear about how doctors, when they're in med school, hemophilia is a sentence and a paragraph and a chapter in one book, and that's about it, unless you specialize in hematology. For you as a nurse, did you have any prior understanding of what hemophilia was?
I didn't even know how to spell the word. I knew nothing about it. And actually, that doctor told me, you will one day know more than the doctors. And he was right.
And how quickly did that day come?
Oh, I'd say it happened within a year. I learned all about it, just living it and, you know, investigating and being your mom.
And when you say investigating, so, there's learning by doing and by being a mom, but what were the resources that were available
well,
then?
Well, they were limited. Mostly I would talk to the nurses at the treatment center. They would, you know, tell me things, what to look for. And just from my experience, I learned, you know, about your joints and if they were red, if you started limping. There was no internet to look anything up. So in that way, you didn't have too much to go to.
Now, you didn't connect with the hemophilia chapter in New York or with other moms. Some people take comfort from making those connections to other parents or with the chapter. Was that something that wasn't of interest, you didn't know about, or what about that kind of community aspect?
I didn't have any desire for a community aspect.
That's okay. You could say that.
I mean, I'm not a joiner. I've never attended a PTA meeting.
Right.
So that's not my thing. I didn't need it. Obviously, though, as an adult now, you need it, which is great. You know, it's a support to you. But back then, I didn't need it. I had any questions I had, I would ask the nurses or the doctor during our, you know, biannual visits. I didn't have a need to sit in a room with a bunch of other people and discuss it.
No, fair enough. But you did, so, you know, there's often talk about how hemophilia doesn't just affect the child that has it, but it affects the whole family. We were just talking before we started recording about sibling dynamics and, you know, it affects the siblings, it affects the parents, it can put a stressor on the parents' ability to work and make money and blah, blah, blah. And being a single parent with two kids with hemophilia, I imagine that was not a small consideration, how to balance what it meant to care for two kids with hemophilia while also being a single parent, but setting up a support structure. How did you think through that when you were having to make those kind of decisions?
Well, of course, I always had my mom, your grandmother. I worked nights. She worked days. She would come to us. I would walk out. I would walk in. She would walk out. I mean, so I was very blessed like that. I had your aunt and uncle. For a while, I had your grandmother. So I had great support and I was very up on insurance. I was always with the insurance companies. I knew what to do. I never had a lapse in insurance ever. I had very good experiences with the insurance companies, actually. I've never spent one penny out of pocket on hemophilia. And I know that's not the norm, but with all the different insurance companies we've had in my job, I found them to be very, very good. I know that's not the thing to say, but that was my experience.
No, it's not the thing to say. I mean, I think one of the bad perceptions is that, you know, insurance companies are the bad guy. And it's like, well, no, it's the way the system is set up is flawed.
And actually, you know what? One time I did, I don't even know if I ever told you this. I had ordered something. It was during one of the shortages and then I got it and they jumped through hoops to get it to us. I think it was bad weather or whatever was going on. And I wrote the CEO of Blue Cross at that time a letter, handwritten letter, telling him how happy I was with Blue Cross and he's never let me down. And it was very emotional. He wrote back.
What'd he say?
I don't know. He was like, oh, I'm glad that you're happy with our service. We aim to please, blah, blah, blah.
He probably doesn't get too many of those letters.
I can't imagine.
Yeah, but I remember that.
Balance off the many highs of 2018, there were some unfortunate lows as well. In February 2018, we found out that community member Barry Hardy committed suicide at 52 years old. And this was really, really devastating to the community. The community was able to come together and honor Barry's legacy with a Wheels for the World ride in August. And Bloodstream was there to capture the event, to honor Barry and to get some interviews with the people who knew Barry best. So enjoy a few of those clips from that day, that really wonderful day honoring the life of Barry Hardy. On a cloudy Sunday, celebrating the life of Barry Hardy. We just finished up his memorial ride. I'm here with Patrick, his nephew. Patrick, tell me what today meant to you.
It was a great ride. It's great hearing everyone's stories about my Uncle Barry and learning some new things about him that he did and just the impact that he had on the community. And I think it was a great idea to get everyone together and do the thing that Barry did best, and that's ride a bike.
And you had shared with me earlier that you have your Uncle Barry's bike. After today's ride, do you feel inspired to continue riding?
I will definitely like to kind of carry on his legacy, and when I get back, I'll try to hop on it and see how it is for the first time. But I would love to, you know, start getting on it and start riding it, because it can't just sit there and rest away. So gotta make use of it, and maybe one day I'll do one of the rides that he did, and if I can be half the rider and person that he is, I'll be so grateful.
So that would be a really wonderful way to honor your uncle and to help carry on his legacy. And you're a member of the hemophilia community.
Yes, I am part of the hemophilia community. I am part of an organization at a kind of, not camp, but a retreat for young adults and teenagers. That it's called Bleed, and it's FHA, Florida Hemophilia Association.org. It's a great cause, and Save One Life as well is a great cause. But I think that without him, the hemophilia community will definitely take a little bit of drop, but definitely it's bringing us together, and I'm meeting so much wonderful people because this community is a great thing.
Well, I'm looking forward to see how you carry on his legacy. Thanks for chatting with me. So I'm here with Priscilla, and we're here honoring Barry. Priscilla, what did today mean to you?
It's so painful to remember all the nice things that Barry did for me and to be able to speak of him and realize he's not here to speak to anymore. So we have memories, but I have something so special with Barry that people could never possibly understand because of my own son. And that's how Barry and I got to be so close. And I'm tearing up because I knew I would. But Barry was something to somebody, everybody. He was something to everyone. Everyone had a story about what he meant to them if they knew him. Mine just happened to be something that was indescribable because I don't even talk about my son. And Barry allowed me to talk about things that I couldn't talk to my own son about.
And you have you had a special connection to him during his rides. Can you tell our audience a little bit about the slogan you came up with and the support you gave to him, both emotionally and financially, during his rides?
Well, when I couldn't possibly go with him, and I became close friends with him through my emails, I hadn't even met him yet, but I told him that. And we were emailing and messaging each other. And I said, even though I can't be with you physically, I'm going to be with you spiritually. I will be with you every mile, Barry. That's exactly what I said. I will be with you every mile. And then I followed it up with that anagram, W-Y-E-M. The end of every day of his bike rides, you would see W-Y-E-M. I didn't even, if my name was associated, but he knew exactly what I meant. And I didn't even have to say anything more. And I was telling the story about how that got him through a really difficult time when everybody was dropping out. And he thought of that phrase, with you every mile. And he told me that night that actually with every pedal push, he said, every mile, with you every mile. And that got him through that ride.
I mean, that's a... you know, good for biking and good for life too, with you every mile. It just, it's a very inspiring phrase. The loss of Barry Hardy has brought great awareness to the need for greater conversation around mental health in our community. And that's one of his greatest legacy pieces, is the community is now talking so much more about mental health. And there are some great initiatives that have begun because of and in honor of Barry. Here at the Bloodstream Podcast in 2018, we had a huge emphasis on mental health. A lot of my like segments I did were surrounding mental health. One of a really interesting piece that we did this year was in March, episode 22, about a shortage of psychiatrists in the U.S. and what's being done about that. So I thought that was a really interesting clip, and really kind of captures many of the other mental health subjects that we here at Bloodstream do bring up and do talk about, because it is a very important subject to this community. So give it a listen. Thank you. I have a recent Forbes article called "Psychiatrist Shortage Escalates as U.S. Mental Health Needs Grow."
So what's it say?
Interestingly, is psychiatrists are the second most recruited doctor after family physicians, which is interesting.
The second most recruited by patients?
Yeah, patients seeking a physician.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they were a decade ago, they were ninth on the list, and now they are second.
Whoa.
Yeah, so they've really moved up, which I think the stigma of mental health has shifted or started to shift.
I mean, that seems pretty dramatic to go from ninth to second on the list. I think that would suggest that the stigma around mental health has reduced, that people are at the very least seeking it. Probably the availability of the internet makes it easier to seek out what the options are than once upon a time. But nonetheless, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
So that probably means there's plenty of psychiatrists to go around, right? They're so in demand that there must be loads of them, right, Natalie?
Well, there's 28,000 psychiatrists in the U.S., which feels really low.
Yeah. So what quick math here tells us that is one psychiatrist for every 12,857 people.
Yeah. They should have really full patient loads.
Yeah. I would imagine so.
But that number is dwindling rapidly because these psychiatrists are aging. The article states that 3 in 5 psychiatrists in practice are currently over the age of 55.
So 60% of psychiatrists are over 55.
Yes.
Do we have a lot of psychiatrists in school, or the bottom's going to drop out of that?
Well, the AAMC said medical schools and teaching hospitals are doing their part, citing that there's been a 5% increase in psychiatry residents from 2010 to 2015.
Okay.
But educators say there's more to be done.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely.
And then there was an interesting paragraph in the article talking about why, you know, there's the shortage, the aging psychiatrists, but that while other medical specialties such as cardiology and orthopedic surgery offer healthcare providers a profit center based care where patient illnesses can be treated with medical procedures or tangible interventional care, mental health coverage often requires long-term management without a defined cure that often is not profitable. Thus, mental health care is not a desirable service line for many hospitals and other providers, as are the other specialties.
So once again, that profit motive comes in as an underlying cause of a problem that we're presenting here.
Yeah. So it's definitely a problem. I know that there's a couple things in government that are happening to help with physician shortages in general, but not necessarily psychiatrists. Chuck Schumer of New York was pushing a 15,000 residency position under the so-called Physician Shortage Act of 2017.
A 15,000, what is that?
To add 15,000 residency positions.
Oh, in the state of New York.
In New York. So, and that's called the Physician Shortage Act of 2017. So that should help this.
And that's something that's passed? Or he's lobbying for it currently.
He's pushing.
Oh, okay. All right. So. Yeah. Keep pushing, Chuck.
But yeah, so I mean, that'll help in general, and hopefully some of those 15,000 choose psychiatry.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, when that profit motive is an underlying factor within the healthcare system, and it's just that paragraph you read makes a great point that it's long-term management, often with no discernible cure.
Right.
So that's challenging. Now, the one thing that sticks out before we sum up and move on here, was there any reference to, does the shortage have anything to do, according to the article, with a rise in other clinicians who work within mental health, like psychologists or other mental health providers?
No, the article specifically talks about psychiatrists, not psychologists or social workers.
Okay.
And psychiatrists are the only providers that can prescribe medicine.
Right. That's true. So I guess in the most severe or significant cases, it's psychiatry is the probably most often the route to go, and that shortage is going to be most felt. Okay. Well, thanks for presenting that. Not exactly. What do we do? What do we do about this?
I don't know, but it's good to think about. And, you know, if you're considering medical school, consider.
If you or someone you know is considering medical school, shove them aggressively towards psychiatry.
Yes, we need you.
If they are resistant to it, that's okay. They can talk to a colleague about it. And get
they can talk to a psychiatrist.
Yeah, exactly. It'll be fine.
In May of 2018, Patrick was in Scotland for World Congress, and when he returned in June, we recorded episode 25, and he gave a pretty succinct overview of his time in Scotland. If you want to listen to a more detailed review, he did record daily recaps, and we have that available here on the pod. But for now, enjoy the small recap from episode 25.
How do I, my note now says back from Glasgow. So help me transition.
You are back from Scotland.
Yeah.
How was it?
Good. Is that interesting? They heard me talk about that every day in the Daily Recap podcast.
But was everyone who's listening to this listening to that?
Well, I don't know, but it, you know, you can get a better sense if you had. Scotland was great.
So for those who weren't listening,
yeah,
brief recap of your experience.
My experience was it was great. The conference was held in a lovely part of downtown Glasgow, so there was an interesting cultural component to the entire thing. As always, it was attended by a diverse group of clinicians, researchers, patient organization leaders from all around the world, intermingled in this very rare circumstance that only comes up once every 2 years. The sessions were dynamic. There were interesting people online giving takeaways, screenshotting, or taking cell pics of slides, adding some commentary, which was really helpful because there's so many things happening at once. You can't be at everything. And in general, I thought there was some great stuff presented about future treatments, humanitarian aid developments, and an uptick in the recognition of advancements and the need for more advancements for women with bleeding disorders. So that was kind of my experience. That and the inability to adjust to the time zone and the fact that it was bright until 11 o'clock at night kind of round out my experience of Glasgow.
They were full days. They were long days.
They were long days. And then like when you were ready for bed, it was like still bright. And I was like, how is it still going? And then it was bright again at like 5 a.m. It was just very strange. The first few nights having trouble getting used to the time change, and then the light wasn't helping. It was a whole thing. But it was wonderful.
One of my favorite guests of 2018 was Rebecca Haber. Meeting Rebecca this summer really was a collision of my two worlds, being a member of the bleeding disorders community and being a doula. It was so special to talk to her about her journey of learning she had a bleeding disorder and the impact that that had on her being pregnant. Enjoy. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. As I had mentioned earlier in the podcast, Rebecca and I had met. She was looking for a doula, and unfortunately, I am not available to be her doula. But I did feel compelled to meet with her, and I feel like the reason was because during our meeting, I found out that she has hemophilia C. So, yeah, we're just here to chat about that. It's a very interesting.
And I should add too, though, that she found out she has hemophilia C through this pregnancy. It wasn't something she was aware of prior to this. The process of being pregnant revealed this kind of an interesting, specific wrinkle to Rebecca's story.
Actually, I found out before we got pregnant because we did some genetic testing to sort of see what, you know, like, I don't know if we were gonna have to
anything to look out for.
Yeah, anything to look out for, because I'm the Ashkenazi Jew lineage, and apparently we have a lot of issues. So, so they recommended doing the Ashkenazi panel. So that's how we found out.
Okay, Cool. And that was my first question, to see what prompted the genetic testing pre-pregnancy. And
being a Jew.
All right.
So is that pretty common within Ashkenazi Jews specifically to do this kind of genetic testing to just rule out or discover things to be aware of?
I think anytime you go in for any sort of fertility treatment, one of the first things they do is do basic genetic testing, and they ask you your background a little bit. And then once you say Ashkenazi, they're like, red flag. So I think it's just like one of the first steps in fertility treatment generally. Mm-hmm. So that was what happened.
And is there any known history of bleeding disorders in your family?
No. So I actually had like 14 of the disorders come back that I'm either like a carrier or have like a mild condition. And my family has no idea. Like, they had no idea that we had any of this stuff. It's definitely overwhelming to get like the printout back in my email and, you know, see that I had like 14 of these things like red, you know?
Yeah. So.
And your immediate reaction surrounding the diagnosis of hemophilia C. So your family was like shocked, and you were shocked to get the 14 red flags. But did you have any, like, this being something that could affect your pregnancy and labor and delivery? What was your immediate reaction?
This was one of the less concerning ones for me in terms of immediate reaction, because I'm also a carrier for something called Fragile X syndrome. And in terms of reproducing, that was definitely like the more concerning thing. So I think a lot of our attention went there initially. I also have another weird bleeding disorder that's called, I think it's called prothrombin thrombophilia, which is like the opposite problem. It's like, you guys probably know, it's like you're more prone to blood clots. So they were like, well, you're a medical anomaly.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. You've got one where you can't clot and one where you might clot too much. So I don't know. So I guess that was my general reaction. It was just like, great. You know.
And has this knowledge of both bleeding disorders changed any of your considerations during this pregnancy or thinking about the labor and delivery?
So the prothrombin thrombophilia was nerve-wracking at the beginning because, you know, you're more prone to blood clots when you're pregnant. The factor 11 deficiency with labor approaching has been a little bit of an issue, and I've had to go see a hematologist and have blood work done and, you know, try to figure out a contingency plan. And so that has been a little bit stressful as well. Yeah.
And then specifically when thinking about labor and delivery, are there any kind of preparations you're doing or things you have to think about to prepare with this new diagnosis?
Yeah. So it's been a little bit complicated, and I'm still not 100% sure what I'm going to decide to do moving forward. But basically, it's always a risk to get an epidural because if they get too close to the spinal column, you can have spinal bleeding. And with a bleeding condition, if they can't stop the spinal bleeding, it can lead to paralysis or neurological damage. So for factor 11 deficiency, they don't have the factors isolated, as you guys know. So that means the preemptive treatment is just getting a ton of fresh plasma transfusions. So, you know, there's always a little bit of a risk involved.
So undeniably, one of the best moments of 2018 was the NHF premiere of Bombardier Blood. And Bloodstream was lucky enough to be there to get interviews right after with Chris Bombardier himself and Chris's parents, Kathy and Alan. Let's listen. Here outside of the Bombardier Blood screening at NHF, and I am with Alan and Kathy Bombardier, Chris's parents. This is their first time here at an annual meeting, and they were here to watch the screening. Kathy, I know you saw it in Colorado a couple weeks ago. What was your experience seeing it today?
It was truly a different experience, I think, being with the community and sharing it with them and letting their kids know that they can do anything that they want to do. It was very
good. And Alan, for you, was the experience different? Or how was it for you today?
Well, I'm glad I'd seen it before, but it was still pretty difficult to go through. It was very well done. Told the story wonderfully. It was kind of neat being in the room with all these people that were directly affected.
Yeah, no, it was a very emotional experience today, and watching everyone come out and just so proud of Chris and the inspiration that he has for this community. And I know being parents, just being proud in general, but there's not that many parents who have a kid who has summited Mount Everest, especially with a chronic condition. So thank you both for being here today, and thank you for chatting with me. So I just ran into Chris Bombardier himself, post-Bombardier blood screening. Chris, what was this morning like for you?
It was amazing. It was really great to finally get to share all of those experiences and that journey with the community. And it was a lot more emotional than, well, not more than I expected, but just as much as I expected. But it was really cool to just feel the energy in the room and just finally have it out there and out there with the community. It's great. It's really great.
Was there any point in the film that the community reacted in a way that was surprising or interesting to you?
Maybe not surprising, but I liked when they laughed at Jess and I's corny jokes. That was really awesome. And I think that was my favorite part of the whole thing is getting to share, you know, Jess and I's relationship and how she supported me through all this. I think that was the most special part to be able to show that to the community.
And, you know, it ends on this kind of epic, like, what's next moment. Not to blow the film, but do you know what's next?
Well, next adventure, I guess, is we're moving to Boston in 2 weeks. I'm going to start working for Save One Life, which is really exciting. Doing more international work, which is where my real passion lies. So I'm excited for that new chapter and see what we can do in that realm.
Awesome. Well, thank you. I know that you are heading to the exhibition hall and are a very popular man. So thank you for taking a minute to talk to Bloodstream.
Well, that wraps it up for 2018, a year in review. I hope you enjoyed listening as much as I enjoyed hosting you on that journey. If any of those clips interested you, you can go find full episodes on bloodstreammedia.com. This month's episode of the Bloodstream Podcast is brought to you by Shire. And for that, we say thank you, Shire. And now I'm going to pass you off to Believe Limited's creative director, Ryan Gielen, who is going to be interviewing participants from this year's Breaking Through Musical Theater Workshop.
Last month, November 9th through 12th, we produced our first ever Breaking Through Musical Theater Intensive Weekend in New York City. Sponsored exclusively by BioMarin, 25 bleeding disorder community teens from around the country were brought to the heart of the city to learn an original six-song musical about growing up with a bleeding disorder. We called the musical Hemophilia the Musical. Songs were written by professional songwriters and producers, but were based entirely on these same 25 teens' original writing. In their applications for the program, we asked them, what would you want to see in a musical about being a teen with a bleeding disorder? Their answers were profound, funny, insightful, and inspiring.
My name is Nathan Mermillid. I'm from Riverside, California.
I've been involved with the Southern California Hemophilia Foundation for a while. Having hemophilia on my life, hemophilia part of my life, the theater part of my life have kind of intersected in a way. I was in a production of Peter Pan. I was playing Peter Pan, and I was flying on stage during a dress rehearsal. And you know how Peter Pan has to go through that like windowsill at the beginning of the show? The people who were flying me into the through the windowsill didn't actually quite do it right, and the wire ended up being a little bit too long, and it flew me straight into the windowsill and it just slammed my knee into it. So that was just one of the sort of theater injuries that I have. And throughout that the run of that show, I was dealing with hemophilia related things. I was on crutches backstage. I was factoring every day, even backstage, and it was kind of cool to I was on crutches backstage, and then I set them down and go on stage and do a scene and come right back off and go on crutches. So definitely gave me a lot of courage. There's a lot of limitations in my life because of hemophilia. And, you know, the arts is one of those things where it's okay. Like, some kinds of sports I can't do, but theater is, well, generally, besides the freak accidents like Peter Pan, but generally a very safe activity.
Hi, my name is Emma Gould, and I'm from Agoura Hills, California. I don't really like to perform much, but I do love singing all the time, and dancing is, it's really fun for me to do, and I may not do it professionally. It just makes me happy, and even if I'm not the best, it's a good way to express myself and make me feel good. There are times when I can't handle things. So, like, if the pressure of, like, my brothers having the severe hemophilia, they get a lot of bleeds, and it puts a lot of pressure on our family, and, like, I'll be dealing with school and other things, and then I just take a minute, and I listen to some music, or I sing quietly to myself, and it just all calms me down and brings me back to, like, okay, you're a human being, this is all normal. It may be a little different because of having the hemophilia, but, like, you know, there are other kids out there just like that, and you just take a minute, and music really takes that feeling that you feel, and it just makes you feel great, you know?
As you can probably tell, the weekend itself was about much more than learning a musical. There's just not a ton of empowerment out there for young bleeding disorder community members who look to the arts as a form of therapy or escape or good old-fashioned self-expression.
Hi, my name is Carson McCabe, and I'm from Arvada, Colorado. Isolation is a good word for it, because you feel like you have this quality that separates you from other people, and it's kind of like a barrier between other people socially, sometimes emotionally, and just isolated is definitely a good word to describe it. The arts are a way to express yourself without that barrier. For me, getting out of my comfort zone is always a good thing, because it helps me become more confident in pretty much every aspect, and especially, you know, growing up with hemophilia, a common theme is that people may feel like they're different or separated. And getting out of your comfort zone like that can kind of make you more confident in yourself and make you feel as though you're more accepted.
You know, it's about a bunch of us kids who have a bleeding disorder, who think we're all alone, and we only have ourselves to help, and no one understands us. But really, there are so many other people in this world who should be educated to know what we're going through, and all those songs take our anger, sadness, and guilt, and all these emotions, and it just singing it and being able to dance to it and express that feeling to people, it feels amazing.
So throughout the weekend, we sang, danced, painted, wrote. We brought in a New York City-based art therapist to guide these experiences. And in true Believe Limited and Bloodstream fashion, we filmed everything so that we could share this experience and education with the entire community nationwide.
The whole experience was just mind-blowing. And I didn't think that people cared enough, you know, to do something like this. And it was our weekend that we could express ourselves through the arts in a way that I didn't even... like, I hadn't even thought of, didn't even know was possible.
I think the best thing that a young person can take away from watching my experience and the others' experience in New York would be just to not let, it was a common theme in the musical too, is just not let hemophilia define you. I think that it would be great for all these people to watch this experience, and then hopefully it will inspire them to be a part of the community and share their experiences too.
In 2019, we'll be releasing a ton of material from the Breaking Through Workshop, including the original music from Hemophilia the Musical. Our video of the 35-minute musical can be viewed anytime on the Bloodstream Facebook page. We'll put a link in the show notes. And applications for the 2019 program will be online probably sometime this spring. We'll keep you posted. In the meantime, we hope you sing, dance, write, paint, draw, photograph, or all of it at once. Happy holidays, happy new year, and see you in 2019.
Would not be possible without the generous support of Shire. Thank you, Shire, for continuing to support the Bloodstream podcast. That is all for this episode. Special thanks to everyone at Believe Limited, the National Hemophilia Foundation, Entertainment to Effect Change, the Hemophilia Alliance, and our sponsor, Shire. Thanks as well to the teens who participated in this year's Breaking Through. You were absolutely inspiring. Please subscribe to the Bloodstream podcast, Ask the Expert podcast, the Powering Through podcast, and the Bloodline Special Series podcasts on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com. You can also find Bloodstream on Facebook at facebook.com/bloodstreammedia and on Twitter at bloodstreaminfo. Reminder to check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreampod.com for links and additional information about the various stories featured on this episode. My name is Natalie Lynch, and I would like to wish you, on behalf of myself and the entire Believe Limited team, a very safe, happy, and healthy holiday season. And until next time, take self-care of yourself.